All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. We are live. We're always live. We're live this week with a special show. Our first repeat guests, two of them, John Ailey and Seb Bunny from Block Rewards. Welcome, fellas.
Thanks for having us.
Ah, it's honestly a pleasure. We've just been a few days together, but nothing beats spending time together. So I'm looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, it's cool. We've been doing the pod for about a year. Company is celebrated its first birthday in July, and thought we would sort of celebrate that with a opportunity to get in person and press the flesh. What are we going to talk about today?
You know, I think for those that aren't familiar with Block Rewards and our story, starting off with a bit of kind of the inception, like how did this come about, Scott? Because I think people are probably curious, and to be honest, I'm curious.
Yeah, I often ask myself that question. I think how did we get here? But the real story is when I first started learning about Bitcoin, I was I think everyone, as they go through a Bitcoin journey, relates it to their personal life first. As you make sense of it, and my background is kind of compensation and benefits. So my first big aha moment after I realized Bitcoin was a legitimate technology and an improvement in money was, this thing is going to be a part of the employee-employer relationship somehow. So I thought about it in terms of, like, you know, is it pension insurance? Is it a perk? You know, it's like this. So this is something that's going to have to kind of carve its way into a very, like, established system already. And I was looking around the landscape for what existed already. And there was a Canadian company in Edmonton called Bitcoin Well that was offering a Bitcoin savings plan. And I just thought the idea was so cool. Like, why can't we just start with something very simple, which is an employer-sponsored avenue for employees to buy Bitcoin through payroll and maybe have their employer incent them with some kind of, like, matching program. And so I got in touch with those guys, and, you know, these classic Bitcoiners, they just, it was something they were doing themselves, and they wanted to make it available and see what happened. And I just wanted to be involved with it. And so some time passed and the market crashed. You know, it wasn't like companies were lining up to offer their staff this thing that had dropped like 80% in 10 months. And that was really, like, you know, that was crazy times, right? So Adam O'Brien, who was guest number one, the Genesis episode of the show, actually got reached out to me to let me know that they were going to be mothballing that product. And I just had a ping of, like, you know, this thing on its own is the foundation for an entire company. And that was the start. We moved very quickly. That was last spring. And that was how Block Rewards began. We transferred that over, and it started as just me.
I'm curious, like, when you think about, well, when you approached Adam and Bitcoin Well, did you have an idea for what this may look like? And that's where you felt like Bitcoin Well and this opportunity presented itself? Or do you feel like when the opportunity presented itself, you were like, you know what, I think I can take this idea and run with it? Like, did you come in with an idea, or do you think you kind of took it and run with it?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably for sure it was the second one. I think, like, in my mind, it's just so obvious that people are going to want to earn Bitcoin and companies are going to want to pay it. And so it's really just a matter of figuring everything else out. And I think in life, you know, you can get mired in thinking about how you're going to do something, and sometimes you just need to start doing it. And so that was really the impetus to put your toes on the ledge and leap and then see.
You're good at leaning into things for sure.
Yeah. But it's been a wild ride. And so then we met Seb. So that was July, and about a month, maybe a month and a half later, there was a block party, a Bitcoin event called the Block Party that happened in Vancouver. And I met Seb in a chance passing, and it was actually Adam from Bitcoin Well who introduced us, which is so interesting. You know, these people, how it all happens. And remember that day, obviously?
Absolutely. He was selling us on honeybees, and he was talking about his farm and everything. And I was just like, man, this guy Scott is rad. And Adam, yeah, I want to talk to Adam. I want to hear about honeybees, but I want to talk to Scott.
Yeah. So Seth and I, you know, like we recorded an episode, I think you were episode 5 on the show. And at that point, you know, we were still just really acquaintances. Like it was, that's an interesting thing to look back on with how things turned out.
Absolutely. You know what? There is a book by Nassim Taleb called Fooled by Randomness. And he talks about how many of these things in hindsight look like this very clear path trajectory. And it's just a heap of random events you can string kind of a thread between. And what I find is so interesting is when you look at our trajectory, it really feels synchronistic. It may have just been random, but to me, it very much feels synchronistic. Like we've met this incredible team. And for those who aren't familiar, like we just got off like a 3-day, the little, or 2-3-day little summit. And some of the synchronicities, some of the situations that arose really feels like we're meant to be here and we're meant to be creating this product. And it very much feels that way. And so even just being on the team, I feel so like honored and lucky to be on the team. I'm really excited to see what we can build as a team.
Nothing happens by accident.
Absolutely.
And so it was around that time we recorded an episode and I get a ping in my Twitter DMs from John. And Yeah,
I had, I guess as you were starting Block Rewards, that was when I first sort of came upon the use case of employee rewards for Bitcoin and that idea. And I had been sort of trying to solve, you know, this itch of how to start a Bitcoin business and started getting some momentum. Didn't really want to work on my own, but didn't know who to join up with. And I, you know, I saw this, who's Block Rewards? And they've got rewards in their name. So, you know, I better DM this guy. And, it went very quickly after that. And meeting Josh and meeting you and flying out here to check out Kelowna and to sync up, it all happened very quickly. Yeah. And it's interesting because I think there's so many ways to approach how to build a Bitcoin business, but it's still very difficult to find that winning strategy. You know, it's still so early. And, you know, so if you're just a one person project, it's pretty daunting in a lot of ways. And I knew I needed to hook up with people with skills that weren't my skill set. And, you know, having you and Josh as partners just made perfect sense. And then, of course, Seb joining on as well. That was it was a good combo.
Yeah, and for our listeners, I guess it would be Josh Curlett is our chief operating officer, who is sort of a behind the scenes person who is really instrumental in making the business aspect of our business possible.
Absolutely, and you know what's interesting is one thing that stood out to me, and it still does today, is when we first jumped on a call. You mentioned to me about this idea of people getting paid in Bitcoin, and how the current system, the reality is that the democratic current system, lobbying is such a huge force. And when we think about that, corporations have a huge sway in the direction of the nation and what their ability to be able to fund lobbying, to be able to change regulations and legislation, you name it. And you'd mentioned to me on this call how if people are getting paid in Bitcoin, then all of a sudden, this is going to change the incentives in the system. These corporations, given that their staff being paid in Bitcoin, are slowly going to swing pro-Bitcoin. And so now we've got this huge lobbying power behind us. And although I don't necessarily agree with lobbying, I don't agree with the outcomes of lobbying, the reality is we still have to play by the rules of the system. And when we're playing by the rules of the system, if we've got thousands of major corporations that have the power to kind of push legislation and regulation, maybe they can slowly sway it in our favor. And I was like, this isn't just like a groundswell of just individuals buying Bitcoin. This is now how can employees start to influence corporations that can start to influence the direction that we're heading on the democratic, like political side of things. And that to me, I was like, I'd never even thought about that. That's freaking fascinating. And that kind of really was this like inception pill for me to want to kind of dive into Block Rewards.
That's cool. I don't know if you've ever said it to me exactly like that. You know, it's like things are different when you're talking about money, but it would have been impossible looking backwards to imagine governments stepping in to tell businesses that they weren't going to be allowed to use email. Especially as it represented an improvement to removing friction, an obvious point of friction in business. And to me, like this is the same thing. Like, and I really, you know, landed for me yesterday, John, in our meetings when you were talking about Bitcoin's place in the stack of internet protocols. which I think is a really big idea for people to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I started building software in 1999, and it was just the internet was an open field, and it just felt like you could build anything and you could create anything in this new digital world. But we ran into the payments problem. Like, you could not route a payment through the internet. It had to go through a bank. And so it was not, you know, you could move these digits all over the place, but once it became money, it was very slow. And so we actually built our first CRM software almost as if money could be transferred, and we literally ran into the problem. And so we went on and built a successful CRM system, and we're selling software to financial services industry. But essentially, we would do all the all the data manipulation and manage the CRM day to day. But then with our clients, we would be sending the money basically every 2 weeks. We'd do a database dump between the two companies and just sort of share a ledger between the two companies. And because there was no way to actually throw the money across the internet in a frictionless way. And so essentially, you do all these things, but then you have to work around the payments problem because the banks aren't going to let you do it without so much friction. And so, it really, I mean, when I understood Bitcoin, I started to realize that slowly it would solve the payments problem. I mean, it takes some time, but, first Bitcoin Core and then Lightning, and then the new protocols on Lightning, including L402, I think, at its base layer, enable Bitcoin to be part of the internet stack at its basis, throwing information packets and payments at the same time with zero friction. And so it's truly streaming money. It's the Antonopoulos, the internet of money. And the L402 protocol is still very new, but once the use cases start to pile on, I think it's just going to speed up the development very, very quickly.
For us, people who are a little bit older than other people, and we remember the earlier days of the internet, I think the change is just slow enough that people who've been around for the entirety of the internet can lose sight of how much it's continually evolving. Like, the internet is so different today than it was in 2014. And it's like incomprehensibly different than it was in 2004. And I think we got the internet at my house in 1994. And I remember my mom sort of sitting me down to explain, like, we were getting this thing called the internet. And that was like just one of these moments that sticks out in my teenage years. And like, the internet itself is a continually evolving technology with no endpoint, right? And this money thing is going to absolutely change the way we think about kind of the digitization of everything, right? The way we think about consuming products, purchasing, interacting. Like, money is the missing piece to like really speeding this thing to light speed.
I couldn't agree more. And I think when I look at it from the perspective of like a mountain biker and tools and nuts and bolts, you have metric systems, you have imperial systems, you have all of these various systems that you need different tools for just to achieve the same result. And when we think about money, when we think about language and just exchanging information, if you're able to just have a standardized system, one that everyone is able to communicate on, just the efficiency gains on that alone are just mind-blowing. And I think that fiat currencies, every single country essentially has its own currency. And they've got exchange rates, you've got intermediaries between those exchange rates, you've then got the internet, you've got companies that then manage those payments, thousands of different companies, and it's just all of those add layers of friction. And so the more that we can get down to that base layer, as you're saying, John, and just have like a decentralized distributed system that everyone is operating on and we're all talking the same language, the benefits are just immense. And I don't think people quite just understand just how immense.
Yeah, I mean, it's the decentralized nature, but it's also the fact that you are sending value, an actual asset, that a bearer instrument, piece of money to that person. They get it and they own it. Everything else before that was basically a debt-based money. And so, you're always sort of going, in smaller or bigger increments, you're going into debt to get what you want on the internet, because you're essentially fronting your money, you know, for a monthly subscription so that you can have access to this thing for 30 days. Whereas if you can actually pay as you wish for it, as you need it, and pay with a bearer asset, it's a perfect exchange. There's no debt. There's no, you know, it's a pure value transfer. I think that's something that people don't quite understand how revolutionary that is, and how we kind of have this feeling that we need to go into debt in order to get something we want. Whereas I think with Bitcoin, it's going to literally turn that on its head, and we're going to start to actually feel the wealth that we have and be able to apportion part of it to someone else who then can also accumulate wealth themselves. So yeah, I think it's very hard to imagine how this thing turns everything on its head so radically. Yeah.
And even just the removal of intermediaries and institutions. So if I'm buying something from you, like, I'm literally sending you the money myself, and that there's nothing in between us. Like, it's a digital version of a physical, like, exchange we would have had in person 2,000 years ago when we were using metal money instead. And that idea through Bitcoin is possible anywhere in the world. You know, I was thinking about what you were saying about borders and the number of different currencies, and borders, political borders themselves, are immense points of friction and gates on capital flowing freely. So we're also talking about sort of opening the floodgates of money and commerce in a way that is, you know, to your point, Joe, like, it's hard to imagine what this means, because a global money, universally recognizable, worth the same everywhere in the world, can be transported anywhere in the world, in the speed of light. Like, what can that do to change how we think about what's possible on the internet? And that's really the part that is going to be, you know, like, buckle up. I was joking about they're making a sequel to the movie Spaceballs. And for anybody who remembers Spaceballs, it was like one of the funniest scenes in the movie is Rick Moranis' character is like, they need to catch up to this spaceship that's outrun them. And he's like, ludicrous speed, go. And I'm just like, get ready for ludicrous speed. Like, this thing is going to be wild.
No more bankers in the way. The bankers are there to rent seek and get in the way of that friction. And without that friction, I mean, I think it's, I heard a stat that over time, you know, over the last few hundred years, bankers have gone from, or like the financial aspect of our economy has gone from 2%, you know, in 1600 to 25% today. And there, it's just literally middlemen who, I believe Bitcoin completely eradicates like 95% of that. And they're not serving humanity anymore. They had a time when they needed to be here, but with Bitcoin, really, not only can you be your own bank, but the internet and the Bitcoin network becomes a payment world for you without bankers. It just does it.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, when El Salvador adopted Bitcoin back in 2021, it really became apparent how we talk about this idea, well, Bitcoin's just going to remove those middlemen. But when you actually see it take place, it's truly profound to see that happen. And I think what really kind of stood out to me is El Salvador has something around like 50% of its GDP. So for those that aren't familiar with GDP, gross domestic product, just monetary transactions that take place inside the country. And 50% of their GDP comes from remittances. This is El Salvadorians living overseas, sending money back to their family. But what's interesting is that if you're trying to send money from the States or some other Western country back to El Salvador, the fees on those are sometimes upwards of 30%. That's mind-blowing. So if you know that 50% of their GDP comes from remittances, and 30% of that is going towards Western Union and these major corporations, you can improve GDP overnight if you just collapse that fee. And I think Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, you're seeing El Salvadorians overseas move Bitcoin instantaneously back to their families. These individuals don't have to go to Western Union where gangs wait outside and try and take a cut. Western Union doesn't take a cut. That money goes straight back to the families and the local community, which is profound. That's GDP increase of 15% overnight if everyone that was remitting money back to El Salvador was able to do that smoothly. And that'd be the fastest growing country in the world by ways.
I think about it like, you know, AI technology collapsing productivity basically to infinity, the cost of productivity. And Bitcoin is kind of like simultaneously collapsing the financial friction of everything like to zero, basically, with the Lightning Network. This will all be free, essentially, or the fees will be so small compared to what they are now. And even like, I think it was last week, the U.S. government was moving Bitcoin around and they moved $2 billion worth of Bitcoin for 66 cents. Like, and, you know, I don't know what they were trying to prove, but like, you know, I mean, what they did prove, like, just think about that for a second.
They proved that they don't need their other systems.
Yeah, totally.
It's amazing to think that someone in the government is using the Bitcoin network to do that. And they're just sitting on all this legacy technology that's really, they're just proving it's useless, essentially.
Well, what's interesting is there's probably internally, they've got all these permission layers. To be able to move that money alone, they probably went through 50 steps to be able to get that approval. But the moment they had that approval internally, you basically just had to hit send on Bitcoin. There was no permission on the Bitcoin side of things, which I think is profound. $2 billion move without permission.
Jerome Powell's ledger.
They ended up selling some of that, right?
I'm not sure.
I think they sold something like 20,000 Bitcoin.
20 or 30,000, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Germany is dumping its Bitcoin and it's just a catastrophe of the West. These governments that should know better are really squandering a very finite and precious asset at a probably the worst time.
Yeah, they're going to have to buy it back at much higher, for sure. And yeah, it's. I was listening to Michael Saylor's talk at Bitcoin Magazine, the Bitcoin conference, and just talking about how there are only, you know, there's only a room enough for like one or two countries to really go full Bitcoin maxi before they just have so much of a head start that everyone else is going to be behind the eight ball. He's obviously hoping that's going to be the U.S., but it's anyone's game at this point. If you can print some currency and buy some Bitcoin and manage your own house and keep making income, the world's geopolitical power could change in the next 10 years in an incredible way.
Yeah, I mean, and if it sounds crazy to a listener, like, you know, the thing about it is every country in the world right now is creating their own money out of thin air, and they can today trade it for the only form of money that no one can create out of thin air. So, I mean, it's not that complicated. It's
No, I fully agree. And I think one thing that I really do find interesting is that I don't think people quite understand just how much money is stored in all of these other assets when we're talking about like real estate, when we're talking about farmland, when we're talking about bonds, when we're talking about equities. And they're not being stored for their utility purpose. They're purely being stored as a monetary store of value because our money has broken down as a store of value. And so when people think about Bitcoin and we're looking at this thing that is just over $1 trillion, and then you're looking at these asset classes that are hundreds of trillions of dollars, and they're just like, Bitcoin's minuscule. It can't compete. And it's just like, when you realize that when people realize that there is a money that allows them to save, and that's all it does, it's a form of sound money, we're going to see a ton of capital leave traditional assets and flood straight into this digital asset.
And the other asset classes are already struggling to perform that function of being a place to store money under a mattress. Like, there was a news story yesterday about a AAA rated high rise in New York that sold for $330 million in 2006 and sold yesterday for $8 million. It was like basically a total loss. And there are stories like that happening in the U.S. If it's not daily, it's weekly. And this is part of that idea, I think, we were talking about earlier, of as the internet continues to evolve, we're going to see things change in ways that are hard to imagine, right? Like your point, I love John's, you love the example of McDonald's, right? And it would have been impossible to imagine in the late 90s that such a huge portion of their revenue would come from online sales.
Yeah. No, I love that story. I mean, they actually had to go into a lawsuit to get McDonald's.com. I think it was in the mid-90s. Some Stanford professor or someone had reserved McDonald's.com, and it was such a new part of the world that McDonald's actually thought that they owned the rights to McDonald's.com just for being McDonald's. Like, copyright laws hadn't been figured out yet. And in the end, there was a court battle. And in the end, I think that the guy gave it up to McDonald's for a $1 million donation in something that he believed in or something like that. But essentially, they just, you know, put up a crappy brochure on McDonald's.com for about 5 years. And, you know, I was even back then, I was essentially an internet maximalist back then. I knew that every company would be a Bitcoin company, or sorry, an internet company, but I didn't know how. And, you know, I would never even in that state, I would never have assumed that so many of McDonald's orders would eventually come through the internet. I mean, with Uber delivery and all that, the idea of ordering a burger over the internet and these burger flipping restaurants are actually literally internet companies, you know. I mean, not only just how they deliver their food, but also how they take orders and how they communicate within their business. It's so the proliferation of the internet, you know, even to the people who were the biggest believers, is still incredible. And I think that's true for Bitcoin as well. It's just, you know, we just can't imagine what it's going to be like in the future. And it's exciting to be working in it.
Yeah, it's like for people who are tired of things changing, the pace of change is like, we're just getting started. Because when these two technologies sort of become realized, and, you know, it's like the internet, I think you and I might have even talked about this on our episode, but nobody in the 90s was thinking about streaming 4K sporting events on their handheld device. Like, these are just things that like were not on anybody's radar, and that's not that long ago. You know, these things become normalized in hindsight fairly quickly. And so yeah, to me, this marrying of global information technology and money is information. So what Bitcoin really does is reduce money to information. And do it in a sort of purely digital way, right? It's this, I think a lot of people have a struggle point with the fact that it's a fully non-physical, intangible thing. And so that, and it seems weird, even though our money is essentially already, our government money is already essentially that.
That is a big, I think, obstacle where we're used to our money still being numbers on a screen. And so we think it's digital, like it's been digitized on the surface, but just not digitized in its fundamental way. It's sending value over the internet is never easy, because as I've said this before, the internet is a series of copies of information. And if I want to send you something of value, I need to make sure it goes from me to you and that I don't have it anymore. And That's not an easy technical problem to solve in a distributed network. So yeah, it's fascinating.
So I'm curious, like on this idea of kind of value creation and value exchange, like, so we've just got off this kind of summit. One of the kind of projects or we kind of ended up doing was talking about this thing called an MTP, I think it's Massive Transformative Plan or Purpose. And this idea is like, if you were to have like an internal vision of who we are and what we kind of endeavor to do, what would that vision be in kind of a single sentence? And we kind of came up with this idea that we want to harmonize the energy exchange of value creation. And so I'd love to hear you guys' perspective, but what does that mean to you?
To me, it's understanding your own value and being able to express yourself in value in a harmonious way, meaning frictionless. You know, there's so much, there's so much friction in exchanging energy these days, whether it be, you know, your personal energy or your financial energy. And I just think we've come upon a niche where we're starting to see where we can remove all the friction and actually, you know, I don't know how, there's another sort of way of describing this harmony, but it's essentially, you know, legitimate value for value transfer. So that's how I see it. What about you, Scott?
Yeah, I think the energy metaphors in Bitcoin are frequent and obvious for some because of how it works. In the same way that Bitcoin is changing the way we think about legacy institutions like the centralized choke points of banking, I think that how we as employees and employers interact with each other is something that's also become dated. And this is an idea that, you know, it's not always obvious when some idea has become stale because especially, you know, things are moving so quickly now that the change is so fast. But the employment relationship and how we think about things like getting paid once every 2 weeks, these are things that have evolved over the last 100+ years, things like assembly line manufacturing. And from a time where the employer really held all of the power and they were rewarding employees, but, you know, to your point, or you made earlier, John, about credit and debt, in that system, an employee is really fronting the company their energy for the 2 weeks there where they are paying for their own food, paying to get themselves to work. They're paying with their life force, their time, during the 2 week period where they're earning that money, which they're actually then paid back for at when the pay time has been completed. And that is the system of debt that you were talking about. Like, we're going into debt to make money, but not in a monetary, well, even in a monetary sense, because during that time, it's up to pay for my own life. And so it's this exists because of how it had to exist before, but I think it's very symptomatic of the rigidity of the centralized systems of the 20th century are struggling to function and stay liquid as the world becomes faster and more digital. So to me, you know, what that statement is about is like, it actually, what we're talking about in this evolution of information and the internet, it's going to have to fundamentally change the way we actually think about being compensated for work we do. And all of these things are going to have to get as fluid. So, you know, part of that is this idea of like bringing the event closer together where the work happens and the compensation tied to it also happens. And it's this idea of like, you know, as it's going to become as near instantaneous as we can. And I think that it's also like, there's a reason why people are starting to feel like it's a challenge to make a go of it in society. And it isn't divorced from the disconnect that happens between the work you do and when you receive the money for that work. You know, like as everything becomes faster and faster, we need that money now. And so I think these are all ideas that are experiencing sort of like a coming of age. People are starting to get to the point where ready to think about it.
I wholeheartedly agree. I really like how you put that. And I think that the way we tend to look at the world from the kind of traditional lens is that the employer and the employee relationship, the employer is kind of subservient to the employer. But in reality, when you look at it through that free market lens, every single time a transaction takes place, there is value being created on both sides. And I think the employee is offering value to the employer by helping them fulfill whatever the business's purpose is. And so being able to, as an employee, feel fairly compensated, as in I'm being compensated in a money that actually supports me. And over time, hopefully, I'll see my cost of living decline in relation to Bitcoin. I'm being paid in the money that allows me to show up more authentically. But not only that, and to your point, Scott, at the moment, the employee is fronting the business until they get paid, whether it's biweekly or monthly. And so if you're able to collapse that into something that is as near as real time as possible, they're also feeling fairly compensated and rewarded for their energy expense. And so I think that it's truly profound when you start thinking about the fact that this is just a relationship and there's value being provided on both sides. I think that it creates a more fair, equal playing field environment.
That's beautifully said. And it makes me think as well, like this is already a point of friction that every business and every employee is experiencing. So whether the issue is that there's a lack of understanding that there is a solve for this problem. But if you even think about the idea of paying your staff in a currency that is continually becoming worth less and less as a feature, like there's nothing broken about the money. It's designed to become less valuable into the future. So as a company running, you've got your employees, your profit and your expenses, but if you know that the money is going to be worth less next year and the year after, then you need to account for the fact that you're going to have to continually pay your staff more and more of that money, which in itself is something that, you know, we don't always just stop to think about, you know, why things are the way they are, because obviously everybody does it. But that one thing is a massive point of friction on any enterprise, if you really just think about what the mechanics of what's happening.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It makes me think about, you know, the old way of the apprenticeship, right? Someone would get hired and apprentice under, you know, a builder, you know, like a stonemason or something like that. And they would be learning while they're working, and sort of their energy would have a value, maybe a little less because they're apprenticing, but there's not this notion of you need to go off for 4 years, go into incredible debt in order to become a valuable person. Like, you can show up and you can add value right away and then learn while you're on the job. It's just a less friction on the sort of exchange of value, essentially. And I think, you know, the fact that we have to cancel all the student loan debts and go into, you know, ridiculous debt, and you just start at the, you know, start on the hamster wheel from day one. And it's just, you know, to your point in your books, it's just not the best way for us to psychologically live. We're living in fear. We're living in debt, trying to get ahead. And it's the people who own all the resources who are extracting that value.
And what's interesting is, like, we're living in confusion as well. People have no idea to the extent that their productivity is just being slowly kind of eked away from the current system. And during kind of the peak of inflation, what was it, in 2021 going into 2022, I think Canadian CPI hit something like 9-10%. And at the time, I was working for the municipality of Whistler, and we had this kind of big meeting, and the big head honcho came out. There's probably like 20 of us in a room. He comes out and he was like, "You know what? You guys have been working so hard this year. I'm going to give you guys a 5% pay rise." And everyone just freaking cheered. And then I put my hand up and I was just like, I don't think people quite understand that inflation is 10% right now, which means you're actually earning 5% less this year. And people are like, "That can't be true." And I'm like, "It is 100% is true. If your cost of living is increasing by 10%, but your wage is only rising at 5%, that's a 5% loss of purchasing power." And that's this confusion. The system kind of masks the reality of the situation. And people don't quite grasp the fact that, like, they can feel that their cost of living is rising, but they're not doing the math. They don't understand this.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, to take it one step further, when the inflation would have dropped from 10% to 8%, what you would have seen on the news is inflation is down 20%, which is sure. I mean, but
yeah, it's just ridiculous. It's like talking about velocity and acceleration as if they're the same thing. You know, it's just, you know, a number that's going up at a slower rate sounds like it's a number that's going down. No, it's going up. It's just, and yeah, we're all on that hamster wheel, the fiat hamster wheel. It's and it's not going to get us anywhere good until we can solve that from a base layer point of view. Yeah.
Yeah. So socially, like, it doesn't work to have people getting off a shift and sitting in their car, and the first thing they have to do is go on social media to just vent out their frustration of how hard it is just to be a person in society. Like, you don't have to be a genius to understand this is just no way to build a cohesive social structure. And, you know, I think, and that part is like, it doesn't matter whether that evolved on intentionally or not. The reality is that's where a lot of people are right now. And so something about compensation has to change. Like, it just does, because you can't have people, to your point, taking on all this debt. Most people, I think, just really want to be a contributing person in society, enjoy their life, you know, have a family, things. You should be able to do that. And if you're working full time, it's not about minimum wage or, you know, it's not about that. It's about value exchange and value creation. And money just working properly. You know, I think that this is the thing that has really, it's a problem that moves just slow enough that it's very difficult to comprehend how much things have also changed. You know, like, I love to talk about how when I was in university in the late 90s, you know, nobody who was at university worried about owning a home. Nobody. Like, it was like, we're a university, you know, we're all going to get out into the world. And like, these things were still givens. And that's really not that long ago. Like, and today it's completely reversed. I would say most people in university probably feel like home ownership, if they're in a big city especially, is maybe not realistic for them ever.
Yeah. My parents bought their house and their cottage with no mortgage. You know, prices were cheaper then compared to wages, and they were successful enough that they could just buy a house outright. That's just absolutely, you know, out of the question these days. And I love how no one's saving anymore. I mean, you are socking away money, but you have to invest it. There's no savings anymore. I mean, no one puts money in a savings account. And this is, you know, Bitcoin can make savings, you know, a real thing again. You know, all these people who, you know, don't care about learning about finances, they are falling behind because they literally just have been doing saving their money the way that, you know, 40 years ago worked. It just doesn't work anymore. And it's you shouldn't have to be a financial guru to just stay ahead. And you know, those people get off the shift and, you know, they get onto TikTok and complain about it. It's like those people after those days, they're now actually expected to figure out where to put their money in some kind of, you know, out of the risk curve asset. And it's ridiculous. You know, we should be doing the job we're told to do, and we should be able to live a decent wage.
Now, and the repercussions of this are just kind of unfathomable. And I think this is what I really try to talk about, and kind of the hidden cost of money is just to what extent does money really weave its influence into how we show up as individuals? And so when you have a money that is breaking down so much so that people aren't even sure how they're going to put a roof over their head, we're seeing like the rate of newborns just dropping off a cliff. Like people aren't having kids because they don't know what their future is going to look like. And then even from the farming perspective, and I think this really opens my eyes, when you have a farm, the value is in the land and not on the farm, and people all of a sudden are buying up farmland left, right, and center to store value. Then they're not using that land to go and create value for society. They're not growing crops. They're just storing value in the land. And so increasingly, farmers are not able to really show up. They have to rely on subsidies, and then the government kind of directs that, what it is that they grow. And so whether it's an individual trying to show up and want to raise a family and purchase a house, whether it's a farmer who's just wanting to try and pursue his desire to be able to support his community, when money breaks down, it really impacts all of these different areas.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. I mean, I love the fact that the interest rates, the banks, you know, the banks now have higher interest rates, but they didn't increase the savings account interest rates. Like, how does that make sense? How do they get away with that? It's just like another rug pull. And everyone, you know, the smaller and smaller number of people are getting a chance to be exposed to the abundance of our world, this, you know, value creation. You know, it's becoming a 1% world. And that's the fiat system.
That was one of those kind of tipping points for me. Again, when you start diving into more like free market economics, Austrian economics, when you kind of come to this realization that what are interest rates? Well, interest rates are just a measure of risk in the economy. Interest rates are, hey, I've got spare capital and I'm willing to lend it to you, but I have to be rewarded for one, not only the risk of you defaulting, but also I'm lending you capital. So I want to be rewarded above and beyond inflation. And when we look at our current centralized system, those in positions of power that kind of govern the monetary system, most of the time, interest rates are sitting below inflation. So what does that mean? That means that those that have capital that are in a position to be able to lend are actually spending money to lend their money to someone else, which is mind-blowing. And then you just got to ask the question, well, who's the biggest debtor? Who benefits from this? Well, it's the government. The US government is the biggest debtor globally. And in most countries, the biggest debtor is their government. And so they're in a favorable position when they can borrow from their populace at rates below inflation. They're being paid to borrow money from their populace.
Yeah, I almost want to just let that sink in for a second. You know, what's tragic about that point, Seb, is functioning money is a tool to provide certainty. You know, I think when people can think about money working with confidence, it enables them to think about planning for the future, the cost of reasonable assumptions about what the cost of things will be in the near term and in the distant future. And so by the virtue of the biggest debtor causing this problem, they're actually removing certainty from the people that they are, meant to be serving. So it's quite a problem.
Yeah. And it's interesting. One of the kind of like phrases that came up throughout our kind of summit that we've just had is this idea of kind of realigning incentives. And I think the challenge for the current system is when you're incentivized to borrow, because it's actually favorable to borrow, people just take more and take on more and more and more debt. And whether that is going and buying real estate, pushing up real estate prices, whether that's buying goods and services, pushing up the cost of goods and services, creating inflation, the repercussions of incentivizing borrowing are numerous. And I think that that's where, when it comes to Bitcoin, when you realign those incentives, when you have a money that nobody can tinker with, as we as a society evolve, as we increase our ability to get more for less through technology and innovation, hopefully we see prices fall. And that incentivizes saving once more. It doesn't incentivize taking risks. So you have, hopefully in the long run, a more stable society where people can take risk, but the onus is on them to be able to show up and actually cover their debt obligations. And if they don't, they'll wither away. And so those, that realigning incentives, I really align with that phrase.
Yeah, we did a very early episode of the show with Joseph Barbuto, who is an expert in something called chondritis waves, which is a study of the cyclical, a recurring sort of wave pattern where leverage builds up in a financial system, and then there's a deleveraging. So this has been the way it's been for as long back as we have, you know, information. Yeah, and so I think that, like, yeah, we're sort of where we've reached this point. It's like a bursting point of the apex amount of leverage that can be in the system, and it's probably going to result in a deleveraging event that will seem for many like gravity stop working, because we are just so used to the idea of going into debt to have things we want, to earn the money. You know, like, it gets back to this idea of, like, we are going into debt to earn money. And Bitcoin can change the way people understand money, so that, to your point, John, like, it is money where you have the value now. It's value in and of itself. And the game theory on, like, no one will want to use debt money when they can have money as an alternative,
when they can earn better money.
It's interesting, because there's this idea, which Bitcoiners will probably be familiar with, of Gresham's law. And that is, like, bad money pushes out good. And what people don't often kind of talk about when they talk about this idea of Gresham's law is that that only exists when there are legal tender laws. When you have a government that says, this is the legal tender, you have to use this currency, what that means is, if you're a merchant and you're selling a service, you have to accept the local currency. The individual who is coming to pay for that service can demand that you accept that local currency because of legal tender laws. So over time, the merchant has to kind of, they can't request the better money, they can't request gold, they can't request Bitcoin, they have to accept Canadian dollars, and people are going to want to get rid of their bad money and hoard their good money. Whereas what's interesting in a free market is it flips that on its head. If there's no legal tender laws and you're a merchant, you're not going to accept the paper, you're going to accept the gold, or you're going to accept the Bitcoin. And so I think that, again, there's realigning the incentives in a free market system where you allow currencies to play on an even playing field. Those that don't offer value or support the individual are slowly going to wither away. And those that actually offer value will slowly rise to the top, given that people are not going to accept the poor money.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people will want to say that that's not going to happen and countries will never let it happen. But Russia just made a big announcement about settling international deals, international energy deals in other forms of money, including Bitcoin. And unless there is a total consensus and solidarity among countries, you know, free market principles, right? And it has started with El Salvador, but in Nashville, you mentioned Bitcoin conference, right? For people who aren't aware of this, Robert Kennedy Jr., Cynthia Lummis, Donald Trump, like, everyone was talking about the idea that the U.S. government is going to consider in the very near future holding Bitcoin in the same way the Federal Reserve holds gold.
Yeah. And if the Americans are doing it, you know things are bad, right? Because they're the ones that have the money printer. And if they're starting to wake up to the fact that their money is in decline, then all money is in decline. There's not a single money that will outpace Bitcoin. And you know, it's not even that politically favorable to go up there and support Bitcoin these days. It's still so small, but it's the nexus of the future. So these people are starting to realize, partly because there is a growing population of people who understand Bitcoin, but just because the money is so broken. I mean, it's broken our food system, it's broken our health system, it's broken, you know, every system out there, and everything is downstream of money. And so these people who are in a position of power and starting to understand Bitcoin, that's going to have an amazing knock-on effect with all the other countries. And I would imagine that there have to be a bunch of countries that are starting to get it, and they're just buying Bitcoin quietly. And, you know, we just have to hope that someday Canada's going to get on that train. I mean, it's not going to happen. Things are going to get worse before it's going to get better, but we can create a foundation where when the right minds get in place, they're ready with the tools to actually turn this thing around.
I mean, these are cycles that have played out in history already, right? So countries moving on and off the gold standard, you know, this idea of chondritis waves exists because hard money creates prosperity, and then it that leads to people wanting to get loosey with leverage. You know, it's a natural, like, you know, rotation of human nature. But it's not like this has never happened before. Paper money systems always blow up. And it's just the lifespan of these cycles is just long enough. It's like just longer than one human life. And so I think as we head into this time where money is obviously not working the way we're all used to, it's just not obvious yet for everyone what's...
Yeah. And then you see these wars popping up and it being fights for hard assets. And the you know, the conflicts arising today, I think, are... You know, not necessarily a direct causal because of the money being broken, but it's we're at that part of the cycle. We're at that fourth turning where, you know, things are going to have to get. There's got to be capital destruction at some point, and it's been held on for so long that warships are going around the world, and you know, I think that. As I said, I think things are going to have to get worse before they get better, and we just have to work towards that point where we can build up again and you know, deleverage. It's not going to be beautiful, like Ray Dalio says, but do it as you know, prepared as possible.
And I think as technology is advancing as well, these cycles are slowly increasing or condensing in time. And so I think that people become more aware of them. And with the information age as well, information is being shared so freely. Well, there's still obviously friction on that and then the suppressing of information, but ultimately information is being shared far more freely than, say, in the 1930s and the Depression. People were very much not in tune with what was happening. So I think that people are feeling the effects and people know something is wrong. And to a point that you made kind of over the last couple of days, Scott, which is that the cat's out of the bag. Once a country like the US announces, hey, we're potentially going to buy Bitcoin and place it in our reserve, that's very different to a country like El Salvador saying, hey, we own a little bit of Bitcoin. And this is the largest nation in the world, the most powerful nation in the world, saying that they're going to potentially buy Bitcoin. So whether they actually proceed with it or not, other nation states are going to be scrambling right now trying to figure out, we need to figure this out.
Yeah, it's in the collective consciousness, as you said. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine what the next 5 years are going to be like, but you know, it's one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, over my period of being in Bitcoin, you see the different cohorts of people who understand Bitcoin, and it keeps evolving. So, you know, it used to be just a bunch of libertarians and sort of people out on a certain extreme. And then it becomes a bit more mainstream and a bit more mainstream. And one of the things I love about the team at Block Rewards, included like us, but also the other guys that have joined, is you can see these incredible talents coming into the space that weren't there. The problem is becoming more clear to more people. And generally speaking, Bitcoin, you have to take a while to learn Bitcoin. So you need to be a curious person with skills and sort of smarts. And, you know, I'm just very bullish on the new cohort of Bitcoiners, because, you know, they bring a lot of skills and they really will be able to translate the problems into a solution. Yeah.
Future is bright.
The future is bright. We need to go through a few difficult years, but I think the future is bright. Yeah.
And I think we did speak about this, and I think that it's so fascinating, which is like Bitcoin does have a branding issue. Bitcoin's branding issue is the fact that it is freaking intimidating. And many times we're talking about technology, we're talking about cryptography, we're talking about anarcho-capitalism and all these things. And in reality, Bitcoin is just money. That is all that it is. And so when the average individual grasps the fact that, hey, Bitcoin just allows me to show up more authentically in life and allow me to pursue the things I want to be able to pursue, I think that's when the masses are going to be like, my God, our money is broken. We need to move towards something that actually allows us to show up more authentically, because I think that's when we have a healthier society.
Yeah, I think, wasn't it Tomer who said Bitcoin is just money, meaning it's money that has a sense of justice to it? Yeah.
And that's all it is. It's just money. Yeah.
It's just money. I mean, 20 years from now, we're going to be using Bitcoin just like, you know, you're using Facebook today. Like, we're not even going to think it's the internet anymore. It's just real life. It's going to be embedded in everything. And that will raise all boats. It will make everyone's life a lot better, and remove the unfair power, the unjust power that people have over our money.
Yeah. What's interesting is I was reading a book recently that came out in something like 1912, 1913, and it was talking about the previous 100 years and how the longest period of deflation that the US ever experienced was from like 1860 to, I think, 1890. And during that period, when prices were effectively falling, people's cost of living was getting cheaper, we saw the emergence of the middle class. And I think that many of these historical events have kind of been scrubbed from the history books. We talk a lot about inflation, how we need inflation for growth in society. But inflation at the same time is creating so many of the byproducts we experience. We're seeing just kind of the wealth inequality as a result of inflation, as people can no longer show up authentically.
Guys, it's been a lot of fun. Maybe we'll stop here. If your final thoughts before we sign off.
Can't wait to have a podcast booth in an office.
Coming soon.
It's such a pleasure working with you guys, and such a pleasure being able to sit down and chat. And so I really value the team and really value Block Rules, and I feel so honored to just be able to be here.
Yeah. No, ditto for sure. Yeah, it's great to be part of it.
Yeah, it's gonna be an exciting ride. And for your listening as well, I appreciate you guys tuning in and paying attention and coming along for a ride with us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.